This podcast discusses anxiety, depression, and suicide. If you need support, please call Lifeline on 131114 or Beyond Blue on 1300 224 636. If you or someone you care about is in immediate danger, call 000 now. If you're listening from outside Australia, please refer to your local guides. La 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 la. Hello and welcome to the Anxiety Shut-In Hour. I'm Anna Spargo-Ryan.
And I'm Erin Van Crimpen.
And this is our fifth episode. As you may recall from the last episode, we weren't sure if we would do five episodes. Well, I wasn't. Erin was always sure, but I rarely stick at anything. So this is quite a big deal.
Although I have had my doubts in the last couple of weeks.
It has taken us a little while to get this together.
To get it together.
Yeah.
But now it's happening.
Yes.
It's happening. It's happening.
I don't know what you're doing.
I don't know either. I think it's from a movie.
So, yeah. So how have you been?
I live in Shepparton now.
Yes.
So that's been interesting.
Good, interesting.
Yeah. Although today, like waking up in my own bed, I'm like, oh, I just want to stay here. And I seriously considered not going back to Shepparton today and getting up early. Tomorrow morning, I'm driving back, and I was like, no, that's
good. I feel like tomorrow Erin will regret that.
Yeah, very much. Yeah. So, no, so we're not doing that. But that has been really interesting, and I've been enjoying living the country life and exploring different parts of Victoria, which I haven't seen, and doing a different job, which is interesting. But I miss my bed.
Yeah, I miss my bed too, and it's just over there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're here.
Like, and I live here. But
yeah, it's weird.
Yeah.
How are you?
I'm okay. I'm okay.
Good. Shall we talk about some things?
I guess we should.
I guess that's
like the point of the podcast really is to talk about things, because otherwise we would make like a YouTube channel and do makeup tutorials.
Would we?
I think so. I think that's the only other option. I think you can either have a podcast about this or you can do makeup tutorials on YouTube.
Okay. Well, I'm glad we're doing this.
Yeah. I mean, maybe one day we could do makeup tutorials.
If you're interested in getting a makeup tutorial from either Anna or myself or both of us as part of the podcast, please tweet us at Anxiety Arts or leave a message on the Facebook.
Yeah, if you could. Like, I'm not wearing any makeup now, so we could do an after this where we put makeup on me.
We could.
Yeah.
I'm only wearing makeup because Flip Temper, which we'll talk about later on, but because I have to wear lipstick every day, I feel like I have to put all of the rest of my face on.
It does look very strange if you only put lipstick on, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, for some people it works, but it doesn't work for me.
No.
So.
Well, now that we've clarified that.
We've clarified the future possibility of us doing YouTube makeup tutorials.
And I think we can say safely that that's certain.
Yay!
Yeah, you should be excited. Yeah.
I'm really looking forward to that.
Erin's making a face that you can't see.
I
recommend seeing it, though.
It's a good one.
In the makeup tutorial. We're definitely going to do.
Which will actually just be me pulling faces
I'm really
the whole
glad
time.
We've got a podcast that's just us talking about having makeup tutorials. I'm glad it's evolved into this.
Yeah.
Glad
it's not the direction I expected it to take.
No, this isn't really what this wasn't like my end goal initially, but now that it is here, I recognize that
we're embracing it.
Yeah. This is where I wanted to get to.
So we're talking this month about mental health and knowing things about mental health. And this came up because you had an experience where you had to go and see some doctors and people about your mental health, and you tweeted about spending the whole time explaining things to them and them saying, wow, you really seem to know a lot.
Yeah. So I went to the hospital because I wasn't feeling very good, and it was one of those days where just everything seemed like a way out. I couldn't stop thinking about getting out, and so I went to the hospital and I didn't really know what I wanted from them, but I just didn't feel safe on my own. And, yeah, at one point the doctor said to me, are you a nurse? And I said, no. She said, are you a psychologist? And I said, no. And she said, oh, you just seem to know a lot of the lingo. And it was just interesting. That's not the first time someone's asked me that, but like when you live with a mental illness or any kind of illness for this long, of course you get to know the terminology. You know, I've been seeing my therapist, or I've been seeing a therapist of some description for nearly like 15 years. So in that time, of course I've, you know, I know what I have.
Terms here and there.
Yeah.
You're not doing things like saying, I just feel something and I don't know what it is. Like, you probably move beyond that.
Well, I have. And I mean, and that's fine as well to go to someone and say, this is the kind of the way that I'm feeling. I don't know why. But for us, I mean, we do know why. So if I go to the doctor and I say I have a, you know, I have a panic disorder, I have generalized anxiety disorder, this is what I know about how I'm feeling, this is the way I would describe the different feelings that I'm having, then, yeah, I mean, that's just an outcome of many, many years of, A, of like having an obsessive personality and needing to learn everything about it and needing to know all the terminology and needing to know what's going on in my head and needing to all the things that I need to know because that's the kind of person that I am. But also being part of kind of the medical model, I guess,
yeah,
going through the process of learning and understanding and then treatment.
So one of the things that I was reflecting on as you were telling us about this on Twitter and then, you know, in the time since when we've chatted about it, is that sometimes I think it's difficult and completely understandable, but difficult, that when you go to services when you're in crisis, they're geared to people who are in crisis, which a lot of the time are people who are early on in their mental illness and don't have a good grasp themselves of what's actually happening. It may even be the first time they've even had a mental illness. We've just been joined by a special guest in Emergency Norman.
climbing all over the kitchen table looking for bacon.
And there isn't
any bacon. There's no bacon. It's gone.
He's very interested in what we're having to say, though.
Yes, he is. I'm going to take a picture of him and put it on the show notes. Anyway, carry on.
The people interacting with those people, I think, are often expecting people to not know very much. And so then when you come in, when you're in crisis 5 years, 10 years, 15 years on, having learned a lot, they don't really know how to deal with you because they just don't have to on that kind of regular basis. And so they do start to wonder, they ask those questions of, well, how do you know all of this stuff?
Yeah, I think there's two reasons that you go, generally the kind of reasons that you go to seek crisis support are, as you say, someone who is at the beginning of their experience and has had you know, some kind of event where they don't know what's happening to them or they don't know how to deal with it on their own. And then also people who are having very acute mental health issues. So someone who's having, you know, someone's having a psychotic break or someone's having some kind of extreme mood episode or a schizoid episode or that kind of thing where they are actually in acute at acute risk. And in those situations, the thing is that there is crisis treatment and there is acute treatment that you can give to people who are in both of those situations where, you know, if you have someone who's in a very high risk situation who has an established long-term mental health issue, there are things that you can do for that person in that very extreme situation. And then if you've got someone who's at the beginning of their process, that there are things you can do for them too, which, you know, things like referrals or giving them treatment right there. You need a tranquilizer and then you can have a sit down and then we'll refer you to the different people that you might need to talk to now. And you can learn then more about when you're someone who's got a chronic mental illness and you have periods of acute mental illness, it's very difficult to find appropriate and helpful crisis care. When I went to the hospital and they asked me what I wanted them to do, which I often get, you know, if I go and ask for treatment and people say to me, doctors and nurses will say to me, what do you want us to do? And I just think, well, actually, A, I don't know what I want you to do. And also, I don't feel like I want to give you the answer about what you
should
do.
You're the doctor. That's why I'm here. Yeah. If I knew what I wanted, then I would just go and do that.
Yeah, and it can be really exhausting to have to come up with the solution all the time. So sometimes I just like when I went to the hospital the other week, did just want to go there and say, I don't feel good. Can you please make me feel less not good?
Yeah.
And I don't know what that means and I don't know how to do that, but I just need you to do that. And they couldn't. And yeah, and part of the reason that that was true was because there was nothing that I wasn't already doing really that they could do in addition. So I was having an acute kind of period of extreme mental unhealthiness, unwellness, but the treatment options for it were really very much like what I was already doing. So they could, you know, give me some sedation or just let me have a rest in the hospital, check all my vital signs and things. But apart from that, there wasn't a lot more that they could really do. And I think for me, I found that to be really, it was really deflating. I really left the hospital feeling like, well, like kind of dire and desperate.
Like no one like can help
despairing.
Me.
Despairing. Yeah.
Like I'm doing all of the things that I need to do.
Yeah.
And it's still not working. And I've just got to a hospital where they're supposed to be able to help you when you don't feel well. And they can't do anything.
Yeah, they can't do anything more. When I said to them, well, what I'm already doing is I'm doing this and this and this and this treatment and I see my therapist every week. I'm, you know, all these things that I'm doing. They're like, well, that sounds like all the right things to be doing. Like,
thanks.
Good. Okay. Well,
that was helpful.
Thank you. What else? What else can I do? You know, and all they did really then was they put me on to the Monash crisis team, who I've seen before, and the crisis team woman, the triage person there, asked me a bunch of questions about how I was feeling. I said, look, I'm not feeling very good, actually. I feel like I might be at risk. So, you know, I'm just looking for a bit of additional support and care and something. I just want to know if there's something more that I can do that is, even if it doesn't make any difference, but is going to feel like I've stepped up my level of care right now. And she kind of said, look, you know, we can bring you in to the hospital to our inpatient care, but I don't think we should. How about I call you on Sunday and see how you're going? And that was kind of, that was all they could really do. And they did. They called me on Sunday and I felt quite a lot better by then. But I could have not felt better. I sort of, I don't think that they let me down as such because, and we'll talk about this as well, because I probably presented as less crisis than I was, where I could articulate clearly how I was feeling and I could tell them about what other things I was doing and I could kind of have a lucid and rational conversation with them about it. So from their perspective, it probably didn't seem like much of a crisis. But it was kind of a very quiet crisis, like a real tired, I just don't want to
anymore. And the whole thing of you know yourself better than, like, it's just the medical thing is funny in that you're expected to front up to a hospital and have them diagnose you as being well or unwell, whether that's physical or mental, based on what you're presenting with in that moment, where in actuality, like particularly mental illness, is such a, you can't always tell. Like you can't, like for someone who is high functioning and, you know, eloquent and able to speak and all of that sort of stuff, to be able to just be feeling, I don't know what to do. And I can't help myself right now. That's massive.
Yeah, and I think being able to articulate it can really betray how bad it feels.
Yeah.
Especially, as we've talked about before, when you've talked about it a lot, that it's just regurgitating the same information. And, you know, if you don't seem as though it's hard for you to talk about or that you seem like, you know, you're talking in a frantic way, you're very upset or you've got these sorts of, like the way in which you're presenting is seems like a crisis, then you can't be, you know, actually you seem too lucid to be in a crisis or actually you seem too articulate to be in a crisis. And yeah, I think that, and I think we've talked about it a little bit before where even in going to seek treatment from a psychologist or a psychiatrist, that there is an element for some people, and I think this applies to both of us, of wanting to have the right answers, to have done the research beforehand, to know what we want to get out of it. And to, in most ways, to kind of want the psychologist to reinforce what we already know and then to recognize how, you know, how well prepared we are and how much we know and how self-aware we are.
We want to be the best patient.
Yeah, and that I think in a lot of ways that can really be to the detriment of the treatment that we receive.
Well, I once had a consultant psychiatrist in a hospital tell me that the diagnosis that my treating psychiatrist and I had come up with over a number of months and the treatment we developed was completely incorrect, having spoken with me for 10 minutes after I'd been sedated for a long period of time, told me that the diagnosis I had was wrong and I was just having a little bit of a stress attack and had to come off the medication that my psychiatrist had put me on because, and his words were, they can cause weight gain in women and you can't afford to gain any more weight.
That's so helpful.
So that was really great.
Yeah, that must have made you feel better.
I was, you know, really, really happy about that. I mean, that was just a terrible experience all around. But I think to me that really shows that thing of I was in that moment presenting well, do you know what I mean? I was able to be articulate and forthright and explain what was happening and what I thought was causing the feelings that I was having and all that sort of stuff. And he was just like, well, there's no way you can have the problem that you think that you have.
Yeah. If you had that problem, you wouldn't be able to do
what you're doing.
Yeah.
Like, well, I think that probably my training psychiatrist and I are in the best position to make that decision because he's actually worked with me over a number of months and you've seen me for a number of minutes.
That seems fair.
So, and I mean, it's happened to me a few times, and I think I mentioned on the last episode that I saw a new psychologist, and she said one of the issues for us developing a treating relationship would be that I would have to stop trying to be, I would have to not feel as though I need to be the best patient that she'd ever had. And that was one of the most insightful comments I've had in like 10 years of treatment. Because I do that, and I know that I do that, and I like to think that I'm fooling people.
Yeah.
But for her to say that up front was a big thing for me. I'm like, oh, and it gave me permission to be like, oh, I don't need to know what's going on at every minute.
No. And I think, again, that if that is the way that you feel that you have to approach that sort of treatment, that it will make the treatment less effective.
Yes.
Like my psychologist says to me that I've been seeing her for 7 years, that that I'm the most self-aware person she knows, and which is lovely because I'm, you know, I need positive reinforcement because I'm insecure and also vain, which is complicated. but I have felt since then that I have to continue to present to her as the most self-aware person. That's like a competition now.
Yeah.
Like, do you have other patients that are more self-aware than me now? Like, could you please keep me updated on the level of self-awareness of your patients? And because I've been seeing her for so long, it's been easy to fall into a kind of almost like a friendship relationship with her where, like, I saw her out with her son a couple of months ago. We were out having dinner and she walked past with her son. And I introduced her to my family and she introduced her son to us. And we were like, this is my psychologist. Here's her son. Here's my family. And we were all, oh, we've heard so much about you. And I thought, I don't know if that's the relationship that I should have. I like it, but I don't know if that's the most effective relationship to have with a psychologist where, because sometimes now I go to her sessions and we just kind of have a chat. And I know that that's part of what therapy is, but sometimes it's just a chat about, like, just a friend chat instead of moving towards some kind of treatment for the way that I'm feeling, even when I've got quite acute anxiety feelings. And it's nice to offload some stuff and to kind of, you know, get to have some downtime and have a chat, but ultimately it's not therapy. And I think, and that's not because she's not a good therapist, because she's excellent. But it's just because I want to be seen to, I mean, it's almost like what I really want is for her to think that I don't need her. Like, I'm coming to you, but I don't really need to. Yeah. But now that I'm here, we may as well see what we
can. And because I care what you think. I care what you think about me because, you know, it's important to me that you think that I don't really need you when I really do need you.
Yeah. So I had an anonymous question on Ask from a person who said that one of the things that happened when they went to see their psychologist for the first time was that their psychologist thought they were pretty, and that actually what this person, one of the main things they took out of their session was that they were really glad that their psychologist thought they were pretty. And like beyond, you know, they thought that I was treatable, or they thought that, you know, that my issues were real, or I was really glad to be able to finally go and speak to someone, but I'm so relieved that they thought I was pretty.
Mm.
And I've thought that way about things lots of times, like where I've gone to a doctor and thought, I need to appear to be more sane than I am, probably. Yeah.
And just the little things. It's like when people say, my psychiatrist said to me, oh, you always dress really well.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, good. Good. I'm glad that you think that.
I mean, I'm glad you noticed, because I'm a functional person.
That's fine. I'm high functioning. As part of my work, particularly when I was in private practice as a workplace health and safety lawyer, we often would get psych reports on clients who, not clients, but people who had developed mental health issues as a result of their job. And so I read those psychiatrist reports. They're always interesting, and it's always, you know, part of my job. But then every time I go to see a psychiatrist or I see a psychologist, I'm thinking about the kinds of things that they write in those reports about. They presented well, well-dressed, fully made up. It's a, you know, about like things like weight and height and, you know, the kind of vocabulary you're using, all that sort of stuff. Yeah. So my first few times when I see a new mental health professional, I'm thinking about that sort of stuff less now than in the past. But I mentioned that to someone that day, and they're like, it's completely different. The treating relationship is different to the report relationship, and we would never, like, that's not something that I'm particularly worried about. I'm like, yeah, but I still have to put on that functioning, like it's like a mask or a costume that I put on every day of, well, it's like when I put my makeup on magically, I'm able to cope with the world. I mean,
oh yeah.
It doesn't actually work like that, but that's kind of how it feels.
I think that works for non-mentally ill people as well, that kind of, you know, it's like when they say if you're working from home, to get out of your pajamas because you're more effective if you get dressed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's true. I think but it isn't necessary to do that to the person who is supposed to be treating your brain. I mean, they need in a lot of ways to be able to see you.
For you to be authentic and real. Mm. Yeah. And I'm not very good at that.
I'm not very good at it either. Before I talked a lot about my anxiety, which might be hard to believe, but there was a point where I didn't go on and on and on about it. But I would meet people who would say afterwards, later on, when we'd known each other for a little while, and then I would mention anxiety, or I would, God forbid, have an anxiety attack in front of them or something. And they would tell me that you don't seem like an anxious person. You know, I wouldn't have guessed you were anxious until you told me.
I get that all the time at work. They're like, you're so together.
Mm.
Nothing ever flaps you. I'm like, I'm flapping on the inside.
Yeah, like I went to the fridge before and I thought that I was going to fall off the world, but sure.
it's weird.
It is weird. And I think it's overcompensation.
Yeah.
And so you seem, I think, you know, I often seem together when I'm in a workplace situation because I'm trying so hard not to seem like I'm the anxious person.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I go so far the other way that then all of a sudden I'm like this.
Well, and it's because you know what anxiety is and you know what normal is. And so it's about knowing things. It's about knowing how you're supposed to present as opposed to how you're actually feeling at the time.
Yeah. Yeah, which isn't to say that I want to appear anxious in work meetings, because I don't at all. But it has been about playing a role in some ways.
So I think there's two more things that we would want to say as part of this discussion. The first one for me is that just because you know, so that there are going to be times when you seek treatment and you are going to know more, or you're going to know yourself better, or the person that you're speaking with isn't going to be exactly equipped to deal with you in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay.
Oh, there are so many manifestations of, even within one mental illness, you know, within depression as a mental illness, there are then a whole lot of sub-illnesses of different kinds of depressive disorders. And then within each of those, different people present differently. And I mean, there's just no way you could have one doctor who was an expert in all of them.
No.
No, I just think the important things about that are that knowing more than your doctor doesn't, not your doctor, knowing more than a professional doesn't mean that no one can help you. It doesn't mean that you're a lost cause. It doesn't mean that you're outside of the realm of treatment. Like,
yes.
There's still a lot of things that we don't know about the brain. Most things we don't know about the brain, but the medical model for mental health treatment is a lot better than it was. There are different things that a professional can try with you, depending on what your presentation is, even if you know more about it than they do. Like, if you go to someone and you say, these are the things that I already have, these are the kinds of symptoms that I'm having, even if you're able to articulate them all perfectly yourself. And I think in a lot of ways, we touched on this a little bit before, it is a requirement of mental health treatment that you are able to articulate how you're feeling. But having said that, even if you can't, and even if you know more, even if the doctor that you're seeing doesn't know exactly what to do for you, it doesn't mean that there won't be another doctor who does. It doesn't mean that you don't then get to have access to a specialist who knows more about your illness or your particular kind of symptom than that one did. There's no...
And the longer you work with a certain doctor, the better they get to know you and the better they can model, they can develop your treatment. So, and not just doctors, obviously, psychologists and therapists and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
They might, like, at first you might be like, oh, I feel like they don't really know, but I feel like this isn't working. But then as you get to know them and you start to talk to them, and, you know, they're professionals. They know how to go and find information and apply it to your situation and things like that. Like, there's always more that can be done.
I think it's easy when you're a person who has lived with an illness to believe that other people know more about it than they do. I think when you live with it day to day, it's easy to think that when you then go to a professional, a doctor or a psychologist, and say, these are the kinds of things that I experience, it's I find that it's easy for me to believe that they'll know exactly what I mean.
Yeah.
If I say to them, look, I have periods of derealization and depersonalization and dissociation, and that the words that I'm using are clinical words, they have a clinical definition, but it doesn't mean that the experience is the same from person to person. And it doesn't mean that the professional that I'm seeing is going to immediately know what that experience is like for me. And so I think that it's important to be mindful of a period of kind of introductory period where you can't assume that the person that you're seeing knows more about it than you do, or that they need to in order
to... Or that they completely understand the peculiarities of the way it presents in you.
Yes.
Like, they know the clinical definition of things, but they don't know what that actually means in the context of you and your body and your lived experience.
And in the rest of the context of your life.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think also that part of it is, the lived experience versus the kind of theoretical learned experience. So they've gone to university. And I mean, to be fair, a lot of doctors do have mental health concerns as well. So it's not that they don't and that they're immune to them or anything, but the lived experience is much different from the theoretical.
Yes.
It's far different from the theoretical experience where they may have read about what you're experiencing, or they've seen other patients that have experienced similar things, but there's nothing that's quite like being the person who's gone through it.
Yeah.
And it is hard to articulate. I mean, I try to articulate the experience of my anxiety all the time, and even then I don't feel like I really get it quite, you know.
And you're a professional writer.
Yeah, it's my job to be a writer, and I still can't articulate it. So I think that the discrepancy between what you think you're experiencing or what you are experiencing versus the way that you've been able to convey that to a professional, and then again versus what they understand of what you're conveying to them, there's almost like a translation issue.
Yeah.
But that doesn't preclude you from being well treated or being able to find access to treatment.
Yeah. I think so. The second thing that we wanted to say there is that if you are a bit like me and Anna and need to be the best patient all the time, and when you're going to receive treatment, you find it difficult to be vulnerable. You just find it difficult to open up to people. That doesn't mean, that also doesn't mean that you can't get treatment that's effective.
No, I mean, I think for some kinds of therapies, you know, you need a level of empathy about it. So if you're doing something like cognitive behavioural therapy and that kind of behaviour-based therapy, that definitely works better if you're able to kind of tap into your vulnerabilities.
Yeah.
But it isn't by any means the only kind of treatment. And there are lots of treatments that will assist you to some degree, whatever your engagement with them is.
And like lots of treatments, you can only do what you're ready to do. So if you're not ready to be vulnerable with a treating practitioner, then forcing yourself to do that is probably not going to help in the short term.
And it would depend what kind of illness you have as well. You know, if you've got an illness that is only going to respond to medication or medical intervention by a doctor, then that will be quite a different treatment experience from if you have something like PTSD, which benefits greatly from therapy, spoken therapy and other. But yeah, so I think what's important to, what we don't want anyone to think is that you need to be wholly vulnerable in order to be able to find support and to work towards feeling better, or that in coming up against a person, a professional who doesn't fully understand the situation that you feel that you're in, that doesn't mean that you're always going to
feel bad
and that you'll be on help. You're a lost cause. Because I know I felt like that at times, especially, like we were saying about the hospital. That was a time when I really felt like no one can do anything for me. I'm at the end of my kind of ability to, there's nothing else.
And
I
this
can
is
do.
It. Like, I've literally tried everything. And now I've gone to a hospital and been like, I'm broken. You need to fix me. I've tried fixing myself and it's not working. And they said, sorry, we can't help you. Like, you're like, all right, well.
Like, is there an end of the road?
Like, what's next?
And what do I do now? That was, for me, that was a real, I don't feel like that very often, but it was a real moment of, I just, the kind of infiniteness of it and this kind of everlasting, ongoing battle against, I felt really like I was battling against it that day. And it was very easy to feel as though there were no more options. And that I was untreatable. And I think it's important to just remind people that there are lots of different things that you can try, and that feeling like that doesn't mean that it's true. Mental illness lies a lot. And that's the way in which it does. And I know that having a mental illness can feel like you run out of energy as someone who has a mental illness to persevere. And I think you want the first person that you talk to about it to have the answer. Like, I know when I'm feeling very bad, I will go to my therapist or to a doctor, like at the hospital, and say, I really need your help. And all I want desperately is for you to have the solution to this problem right now. And that is really unrealistic. And I think everyone needs to be mindful of the fact that that is unrealistic, that you can't expect to get the solution. That there's rarely a solution, one solitary singular solution, and also that you can get that from the first person that you speak to, that getting treatment for mental illness also does have lots of trial and error elements to it, whether it's trialing different medication, whether it's trialing different therapists, whether it's, you know, or a combination of both of those things or other things. And I think that, when it does start to feel like you don't have any more energy to persevere with what that balance looks like, that's when it starts to get really hard. But maybe you can listen to this podcast
to remember is that we're all having that experience. There are very few, I don't know anyone who's started to feel depressed or whatever and gone to a doctor and they're like, oh, here you go, take this medication and you'll be fixed, and then they were magically fixed.
Like straight away, and no one ever needed to do anything about it again.
That's right. That's not the reality. And all of us who are dealing with mental health issues are muddling our way through it with our health professionals in the best we can. And I know that I've found it useful to reach out in those moments and being just like, I'm just so tired of having to tell my story over and over again, or I'm so tired that, you know, that this medication isn't working or whatever. And people have said, yeah, I get that. It's really hard. And then you're like, oh, It's not that I'm unfixable. It's just that it's hard for everyone.
Yeah.
And we don't know, none of us really know what we're doing. We're just doing the best that we can.
No, exactly.
That sounds really depressing, but actually I find that really comforting.
I think it's nice to know that you're part of a wider people we're muddling through. Yeah, and that it's not like, you know, if you have a broken wrist and someone sets it in plaster and then in 6 weeks it will actually be fixed. Yeah. It's not like that. It's, you know, unfortunately, it will be a longer-term issue in one way or another.
Yeah.
For some people that's all their life. For some people it isn't, but it is more than just here's the fix now.
You're 6 weeks and you're better. You're cured.
You're all fixed. So I hope that things like this podcast give people some a bit more stamina in being able to feel as though they're not isolated in their experience.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Well, I know that reading things that you've written and, you know, just reading other people's experiences and, you know, because I'm not big on going out to meet people. So
why would you?
So knowing that, you know, just knowing that there are other people out there, you know.
Oh, I remember
speaking publicly about it.
Yeah, three or 4 years ago, I honestly thought I was the only person who'd kind of had my specific anxiety experience. And now I know that I'm not at all.
Yeah.
But it really, it really did feel like...
And while that's depressing in one way, there's so many people out there who feel terrible all the time. On the other hand, you're like, well, how great that we can experience this together and help each other through it.
I feel very lucky that being on the couch inside feeling bad became very hip recently. I feel like I've been working my whole life to work towards being part of that community.
Yeah. And now you're there.
And now I'm here and I love it because I'm always on the couch watching TV. Yeah, but no, I am, being part of a community is helpful for me. I hope it's helpful for other people.
Anxiety. It's beautiful.
Thanks.
So for those of you joining us for the first time, this is a segment where Anna and I answer your questions from our perspective. You can do this yourself by tweeting us at Anxiety Arts or to either Anna or myself individually, Anna being at Anna Spargo Ryan, me being at Erin Arie. You can comment on our Facebook or you can email us at anxietyarts@gmail.com. You can always be anonymous if you would prefer. You can do that by sending us direct messages or emails.
Okay, so our first question is from Anita, who messaged us on Facebook. And she asks, what's the best way to socially approach someone you know has social anxiety? As someone with every kind of anxiety known to life except social anxiety, I often find myself really excitable when talking to people and being chatty. But I'm also acutely aware of how uncomfortable face-to-face human interaction can make others. Do you have any tips on how to proceed? Because generally the awkward people are the most interesting ones and I don't want to frighten them away.
I like this. I like this because it suggests that I'm interesting.
Yeah, I don't know if she's met you. Like,
well,
I was trying to insult you and you just didn't give me anything.
I'm kind of interesting.
No, you are interesting. I was just having a joke.
Very funny.
Thank you.
Make fun of the mental person.
Yeah, did you see how funny that was and how we laughed? We laughed and laughed.
Oh, ha, ha, ha. Ha, ha, ha. Well, I do get social anxiety. And the first thing I would say is that if a person with social anxiety has shown up to the thing that you've asked them to, half the battle is won.
Yep.
Because that's actually for me and in my experience and certainly the experience of other people I know who have social anxiety, that's actually the hardest, like that's really where it's the getting there and the lead up to it that's quite difficult.
Mm. Could you maybe explain to us what having social anxiety is like?
Sure. So basically, I don't know, for me it feels like, so I'm an introvert, so I think part of my, if this for me comes from energy and how I know that going to something, a social event with other people is going to expend energy for me. Mm. And if something goes badly and you know, like people don't like me or whatever, then that's going to be a big thing for me and I'm going to have to recover from it and
Like, it's just going to be this massive deal. So over the weekend, I went to visit a friend and it wasn't a big deal at all. I just got in the car. I went, not even once did I think about, oh, I don't really want to do this. But other times it will be like, I'm just like, oh, what if I get there and we don't have anything to talk about? Or what if we talk about something and we disagree? Or what if I don't talk at all, which I do sometimes because I don't find ways to fill silences.
Mm.
I'm not chatty. Like I can hold up a conversation, but I don't, yeah, I'm not a small talker. Mm. What if she thinks that's weird and, you know, then it's awkward. And what if we're just awkward the whole time? And what if she says as a result of that she doesn't want to talk to me anymore and she doesn't want to be my friend? And, you know, what if I break down and start crying for no reason? Like just like all of that kind of stuff.
But specifically in the company of other people.
Yeah, specifically about the actual being with other people.
Yeah.
There's just the being, like actually being in the crowd, there's this, you know, the warm flush creeps up your chest. You're like, oh, my God, people are watching me. People are paying attention to me. Mm. What if I've got a booger hanging out of my nose? Like, you know, like there's this awareness of the press of people around you. And then what if I, you know, and then it's the finding someone to talk to and talking to them just the right amount and talking about just the right thing and all of that kind of thing. It's just this, it's the people part of it. It's not it's specific because I get anxiety about other things, but it's just the specific people stuff.
Yep.
It's that weird. Makes sense.
Yeah, no, it's interesting.
It's hard. Yeah, it's weird. I've never tried to explain it before.
Hmm.
So I guess what I would say is if you know someone is socially anxious and you are at an event with them, go up and talk to them. Don't just leave them standing there, but just do it in a cool, calm kind of way, saying, hey, how's it going? You know, find something that you have in common to talk about and just be conscious that they might be, like I am now, kind of slow in finding their words, or they might be a bit distracted, or while they're talking to you they might get on their phone, or they might, you know, they might seem disinterested in being there, but it's just that they are uncomfortable with the situation find themselves in. It's not actually about you. It's just about being there.
I have to explain the same thing to people about other anxieties that I have. So I don't feel that way around people because I find it quite easy to talk to people and things. But if I'm far from my house, then I do that as well. I'll get on my phone or like look for some way to get out, or I have to leave a room really suddenly. And I've come to learn to explain that to people before I do it. Like, I don't not want to hear what you're talking about, and I don't not like your company. I'm just really anxious.
Yeah. I guess the other thing I would say is if you have met someone in person or online or whatever and you want to get to know them, and you're worried that you're going to frighten them by being too intense and chatty and
that's me all the time.
Yeah. Just kind of start small and say, hey, here's my number, you know, just chat a bit, however that works. And if you know for certain that they have social anxiety, if it's something like, for example, if you were going to approach me about being my friend, hint, I would want you to say, hey, I'd really like to hang out, but I know that that's something that you find difficult sometimes. Let me know if you want to have a coffee someday or something like that.
Mm.
That would be really good. I would really like that.
Yeah.
And then just, like I've said before, really supportive if I agree to it and then later cancel because I'm too worried.
Yeah.
Because it might take a couple of tries before you can actually do it.
Yeah.
But the more supportive and the more kind you are, about the situation, the much, because it's a trust building exercise. It's about me knowing that I'm going to go there and not be made a fool of.
Mm. And that if you can't find the words, or you don't feel like you're contributing to the conversation, or you have to leave, or you on your phone, or
yep.
that no one is going, ugh, Erin's not very good in these situations.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yep. Hmm.
That's what I reckon.
That sounds good.
So the next question, it's a suggestion really, is from at Joanna Muses on Twitter, who says, a good topic could be how to get professional mental health help when you are short on money to pay for it.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty good topic. And well, I thought Anna would have lots of things to say about that.
Why did you think that?
Because you're poor.
Wow.
So rude.
Okay, shepherd and lady.
I'm so sorry. No, just because you've spoken before about the prohibitive cost of
yes,
mental health
care is prohibitively expensive.
Yes.
Yeah, we've talked about that before, where a psychiatrist appointment might cost you $350, which is just ridiculously expensive. So I think the important thing is to, I mean, I put mental health care from a monetary point of view ahead of a lot of other things.
Yeah.
So I think it's important to, at least for periods of your life, to do that.
Yeah.
I think there are times when you need to say, actually, I need to put the health of my brain ahead of all of the other things that I need to pay for. Like, not, and that, I mean, that includes, I need to have secure housing, I need to have good food, I need to have my bills paid in order to feel mentally healthy. If that's part of it, that's fine.
Yes.
But I do think that mental health care needs to take precedence over other things for periods of time so that you can work on feeling better. And that might not be a possibility for everybody, but if it is, then I think that's something that you need to work at. In terms of actually getting subsidized or free healthcare, I mean, you can get 10 subsidized appointments with a mental health professional by going to your GP and getting a mental health care plan. The mental health care plan itself is bulk billed, so you can get that for nothing, and then you can go and get basically half price sessions. So you get about $83, I think, back from Medicare when you see a mental health professional with a mental health care plan. And the way that works is that you get 6 sessions, and then you have to go back to your doctor, check that you're still mental, and then you get to go and have another 4 sessions.
Yeah.
In terms of other care that's free or very cheap, there is public health mental psychiatric care. It's very intense. So like I was saying before about going to the hospital to get psychiatric care, most public hospitals don't have psychiatric care. Most in Melbourne, there are different catchment areas for different public hospitals. So I live in Bayside, and here the mental health care is provided by Monash, which is in Clayton. Their catchment area includes all of Kingston, all of Bayside, I think, and then all of Monash and parts of Glen Eira, I think. So they can offer free healthcare support. So the CAT team that came to assess me, that was a free service that's included as part of your, you know, public healthcare. You can also be admitted to a public health mental healthcare facility. So hospitals that have psychiatric facilities often also have inpatient facilities. They're really designed to contain patients more than treat patients.
Yes.
So if you're having a mental health care crisis, but you're not a danger to yourself, then that kind
of, or other people.
Yeah, or other people, yep. Then that kind of facility is probably not going to help you very much. You know, they're not really set up to counsel you. They're definitely not set up to counsel you. They're more for people who really are at risk, high risk to themselves or to the community.
It's really about monitoring.
Yeah. They're really to make sure that the patient doesn't harm themselves or anybody else. And often people who are in those facilities are
Well, not very not unwell. There voluntarily, yeah. And yeah, often very unwell. So yeah, if you are in acute danger, then definitely go and talk to a hospital about being admitted to a facility like that, because that's what they're for.
Yeah.
In terms of other things that you could do that are cheap or free, there are lots of different ways that you can help yourself. So the things we were talking about before in terms of knowing more about what's going on for you and being self-aware and that kind of thing, there are lots of apps that you can download that will help. Yeah. So there's a series of apps by a guy called Andrew Johnson, who I really like.
Yeah, they're really good.
Yeah, every time I mention him, he follows me on Twitter and then awkwardly unfollows me. It's really bizarre. But he has a series of apps for different kinds of mental health concerns. So there's an app for panic. There's an app for anxiety. There's an app for like sleeplessness. There's an app for stress. There's an app for depression. He's got all these different apps. They're about $3.50 each, I think, but they have excellent guided meditations in them. So you can then work on those by yourself. And they can really help to minimize symptoms of mental illnesses. And there are lots of different other ones like that. Those are just the best ones that I found, and I'll put a link in the show notes to his stuff. Yeah. But there are free ones as well. Beyond Blue has a couple of apps. There's Smiling Mind is one for children. So my daughter is quite anxious and has trouble staying asleep. She's been listening to some of the guided meditations from the Smiling Mind app, which has really helped her. They're not treatment as such, like they're not going to cure you, but they may take the edge off while you're looking for a more long-term solution, or, you know, if you're not in a position to seek medical treatment at that time.
Yeah.
And then there are other things that I think are worthwhile, like online communities. So even being able to speak to other people who are having a similar experience to you, whether it's through a website, a forum, or in social media, things like that, they're obviously not controlled. Some of them are, but most of them are not controlled or moderated. So there's an inherent risk in being exposed to like unmoderated content, but they have really helped me. It's really, really helped me to be able to speak to people who understand the kinds of feelings that I'm having. A lot of the different mental illness charities have free helplines as well. So Lifeline is free. Beyond Blue's number that they have, their 1300 number, that's free. Well, it's the cost of a local call, but it's a free service. They have online chat, some of them. So Headspace has an online chat. I think Kids Helpline might have an online chat. There are different kinds of that kind of counselling service it's a very short-term counsel. It's not a counsellor as such, but it's someone who can talk you through how you're feeling at that exact moment. And if you are in really serious immediate danger, then you should call an ambulance.
Yes. The only other thing I would add is some employers offer an employee assistance program. That's true,
yep. Yeah.
And if you have access to one of those, I really encourage you to use it. It's completely confidential. They don't talk back to your employer about what you're seeing the employer about. The only thing your employer will find out is that someone has accessed the service.
Yeah.
And it can be about work, but it doesn't have to be. It can be about personal stuff that's going on in your life. And often that's a series of six sessions with a psychologist. So that could be a way at least to start exploring some treatment options. And then if you need a referral, otherwise, you know, you can look at it in that way. But I know, like in my experience, people have been really resistant to using employee assistance programs. But, you know, I can't recommend it highly enough. If your employers are putting a premium on your mental health, then you should take good advantage of that.
Definitely. And some of the unis have subsidised mental health care as well. So you can do a similar thing through a uni, get quite heavily subsidised counselling, that kind of thing. Yeah. So I think there are lots of options. In the past I have been very like it's just an outrage how much this all costs and how then inaccessible it is to people who can't afford it. But there are more options than probably what I've been ranting about.
Yeah, and I mean – the reality is, in an ideal world, I say the reality is a lot.
That's funny for like, because I'm quite detached from reality. So it's like you're just rubbing it in my face constantly. Like now, Anna, you don't really have quite a good hold on reality. So let me just tell you again what reality is. Because the reality is, I know you don't understand because you don't know what reality is. That's you know, it's quite hurtful.
That was my plan.
Good.
In an ideal world, it would be free. Like, yeah. You wouldn't have to pay for it. But.
Well, it's the people who have to be paid to do their jobs so that they can afford their own mental health care.
That's right.
You know, there is some government money behind it, but not enough.
Yeah.
So, unfortunately, we have to pay the difference.
Hopefully that helps, guys.
Yes, hopefully.
You guys.
Metal shootout! Pew, pew. Excellent. What made you anxious this month?
Moving to Shepparton?
Oh, yeah.
Because that happened, like, I found out on the Friday and had to move on the Tuesday.
That's my worst nightmare.
So it was pretty anxiety-inducing, but I've actually been pretty good, like, really low levels of anxiety since I've been out there, which is quite unexpected.
It's all the fresh air.
Must be. All the fresh air and the pollen.
Yeah.
my body's probably using your brain all the energy.
Not getting all the oxygen it needs. And that's what's
happening. Exactly right. It's got no energy to be anxious because it's taking up all its energy being used in helping me to breathe.
Yeah, like staying alive.
Yeah.
That sounds nice.
What about you?
I quit my job.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, so not really a big thing. Should I just do another one?
Well, yeah, probably. If you don't want me to talk for the next 3 hours. We couldn't find a solution that worked for all of us. And also I just am tired and I don't feel like I'm, this is so bad to say, but like living in an authentic way. I haven't had time to write anything. I don't feel like I'm being a productive family member. I don't feel like I'm giving myself enough time to work on my mental health either. So I'm going to do freelancing for the indefinite next period of time. Yeah. No, it's okay. When I did, I thought, oh, good. And then I thought, I don't have any money. Uh-oh, maybe I should have had a plan. But I've never done anything with a plan. So that would have been out of character, which would have given me anxiety. I would have been like, why did I make a plan?
Well, who am I? Now I'm having an existential crisis. Exactly.
I don't even know. I'm having a massive identity issue now.
Yeah.
So, yes, I'm going to do some freelancing, which is what I like anyway. I don't know why I got a job in the first place. Really? Anyway, that's me. Yeah. You?
So I've had to drive a lot and that's been making me anxious.
Why does that make you anxious?
Because I'm worried that my car's going to explode like on the road. And I'm going to be stuck on the side of the road.
I'm not trying to diminish your pain.
But it, like I do. I'm like, so my car's going to break down and I'm going to be on the side of the road in the dark.
Yeah. I mean, when cars break down, mostly what happens to them is they explode.
I don't know why I have that thing. It's weird.
I've just had a very anxious month. I felt very unsettled and kind of on a daily basis a bit detached and worried. I have felt very worried. Like I've been worrying about the next day a lot where I've got up on one day and I haven't been able to really sit in that day very well. So I've spent the whole day worrying about either the next day or several days after that or whatever. And that has been very unsettling. I felt very loose, like unhinged.
Yeah.
And that's been gross. And I've had quite a lot of panic attacks for no reason, like just sitting at my table just thinking, oh God. And, you know, when your thinking starts to compound like that, where you start out going, oh, feel a little bit, and then, oh God, it's getting worse. Oh God. And then it just goes on and on and on. And I've been doing that a lot, which I had quite well under control, I'm going to say, like 8 months ago, and now I don't. And so that's one of the things I need to work on. But, yeah, I've just generally felt very anxious.
So in the same vein, I've been a bit anxious about sleep because I'm a terrible sleeper. Not in this, I do get insomnia from time to time, but I'm just a light sleeper and I wake up and my brain starts immediately upon waking up, and I wake up a lot. And because I'm in Shepparton some of the week and Melbourne some of the week, and So it's a different bed, different environment, all that sort of stuff. And
do you wake up disoriented?
Yeah. Mm. So I get anxious about how much sleep I'm getting. So if I get one bad night's sleep, I'm like, okay, that's fine. I can afford to have one bad night, but I can't afford to have another bad night. And then it's the whole, if I go to sleep now, I'll get 9 hours. And then I'm still awake. If I go to sleep now, I've got 8 hours. So, yeah, a bit of anxiety about that. But I've just been trying to do the things I'm supposed to do to stop that from happening, like have a routine, make sure that I'm not doing too much electronic stuff before bed and
meditating. You find that helps you?
Pardon?
Do you, like, not take your phone to bed and things?
I read on my phone or my iPad. So it's technically, like, I'm not still on the electronic devices, but I do find that if I say, okay, well, at 9 o'clock I'm going to stop checking my Twitter and all that sort of stuff, and then from then on it's just reading and meditating and that sort of stuff. So I'm still using the devices to do the things that I need to do, but I'm just not doing the social media stuff, and I do find that helps.
Being tired makes me anxious. I feel much less well-equipped to deal with everything if I'm tired. And I'm a pretty good sleeper. Mm. I go to bed at like 8:30 and I sleep for probably up to 9 hours a night, every night. And but on the weekend I don't sleep very well. And lately I haven't been sleeping very well. I've been very anxious and I've been waking up and staying awake for a good period in the night. Like waking up at 2 o'clock and staying awake until 4:30 and that kind of thing. And the next day, being tired makes me anxious because I feel like the only reason I could be tired is because I'm about to die.
Yeah.
But then also I don't have enough physical and mental stamina to deal with feeling like that. So that has made me anxious lately. Mm. And I don't understand why I'm not sleeping well, because I do normally sleep well.
Yeah.
When I start to not be able to sleep, it makes me, I'm like, oh, well, hang on, but I always think, what's going, why am I,
what's different? Starting and analysing.
Exactly.
I've been anxious about food. Food is an ongoing thing with me, and it stems from stuff in my childhood and blah, blah, blah. But I go through phases where I don't care what people think about me eating, but then I do go through phases where I really, really do. And because that's weird. So I'm in Shepparton, nobody knows me. Like, it's not like I've been to the drive-thru at KFC in Shepparton every week for the past 6 months.
Yeah.
But I still worry about what the people in the drive-thru are going to think if I decide to have KFC. And I'm in, so I'm in a service apartment building in Shepparton. And so there have been nights where I've got home from work late and I'm like, oh, I just want to order takeaway. But I'm like, but then the delivery people will have to walk it in through past the receptionist and take it up into the elevator and walk past it. Like, what if there are people in the hallway and what if they judge me because I'm having Thai food? They're literally not going to know who it's going to be. Yeah. But I get anxious about it. It's so weird.
I do that as well at the supermarket where I'm anxious about what people might think if they look at my trolley.
Yeah, exactly. I get that.
And, usually my trolley is, there's a good number of vegetables in there, and it's not because my trolley is full of chips. Sometimes it's full of chips.
I still thought it was biscuits.
I'm like, there's usually a number of biscuits.
But an unspecified number of biscuits.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to tell you how many biscuits. but I do feel quite anxious.
Yeah.
And I'll always look for a checkout person. If I'm not doing self-serve, I'd love doing self-serve.
Yeah, me too.
But I'll always look for a checkout person who looks like they won't be like,
yeah,
are you having a party? Like, no, I just really like biscuits.
I like young boys. Young boys on the checkout because they actually don't give a shit.
Yeah. Like, God, I want to be stoned with my mates. These chips look really good. I should get some and take them to my mate's house after this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know that just sounded weird when I just said I said young boys, but I hope that we covered that. I think we gave the context.
I'm just going to isolate that and just put it on the internet, just you going, like young boys.
And then I'll never be able to go into politics.
You definitely won't. You might have to also retire from being a lawyer.
Yeah. And a human being.
Yeah, you might have to do that.
Are we done mental shootout?
I think I'm so done with mental shootout.
I'm sure there were other things that made me anxious. I'll try to pay better attention this month.
Maybe you should put them in Evernote or something.
I do normally, but I didn't this month because...
God, I don't. Sometimes I write them on my hand and then, like, 4 days later when I finally have a shower, they wash off.
Yeah. I will send you a screenshot of my list to put up as one of the show notes. Because I literally do it.
All right.
Because that's just who I am. It's yeah. who I am, Anna.
No, I know. I like it about you. I don't do that. That's not who I am.
Shall we plug some things?
Yeah, let's plug some things. Ooh, I'd like to have some things plugged.
I'm going to plug some things for Anna. Stop clicking on it. I can see it coming up. Sorry, Anna's just writing rude notes to me on our show notes. right back at you. So Anna has a Patreon where if you give her money, she'll send you a password to things that she's writing.
Mm.
And she did her first paid content post this month, and I thought it was excellent.
Thank you.
And she's not, I'm not saying that because she's got a knife to my throat or anything. it actually is. I mean, I love Anna's writing, but it's nice to be able to support her to do that. So we will put a link to that in the show notes
mm-hmm.
So that you can go and give her money to be excellent. She also wrote a great piece on essential kits on parenting. Reflecting on some of her own experiences with her two beautiful daughters, who I got to spend some time with today, which was really fun. And I'm not a parent, but I found that really interesting, just reading it from my own experience as a kid growing up and a teenager and being a bit different to the rest of my family, and just as a person to kind of see,
Yeah, it's about validating feelings. And, like, it's a mindfulness sort of a thing, being able to acknowledge and validate feelings, even if they're not ideal feelings or, you know.
It's going to be inconvenient in some way.
Yeah.
So yeah. I recommend that. We'll also link that.
Oh, thank you very much.
And by we, I mean Anna will link it because she's the one who does the show notes.
I will. It's because I'm a web developer for hire. If you want a web developer for hire, then I'm your gal. Because I don't have a job. As previously mentioned, please, please give me work. Erin is doing Liptember. Liptember is like a one of those charity type
Dry July Movember.
Yeah, where you do something every day. And in Liptember's case, it is wearing a different lipstick every day.
Doesn't have to be a different lipstick every day, but that's just my thing.
Do you want
to
borrow some of my lipstick?
I have a lot of lipstick.
Do you?
Yeah.
I don't have a lot of lipstick, but I have some lipstick.
If I'm running out towards the end of the month, I might take you up on that. So Liptember is raising money for women's mental health.
Yes.
It supports Lifeline and the Centre for Women's Mental Health at the Melbourne Hospital. And it's a great initiative. I did it last year and raised $785, but this year I'd like to raise $2,000.
Yep, so if you want to support Erin in doing that, you can go to liptember.com.au and search for her name. I'll also put a link to that in the show notes in my web developer way.
And if you follow me on Instagram, you get to see me posting selfies every day.
You do, that's true. That's the reason that I follow you. Like, I had unfollowed you, but then I thought, well, I want to see these lipstick selfies.
Yeah.
So now I follow you again. And the other thing that Erin did was write this blog article that I will also link in the show notes where she just dumped her bloody heart on the page. I tell you, she's just, it's a very, very moving, lovely piece of writing on her blog about the situation with refugees, which is just at the moment just hideous and a whole different just world of just terribleness.
Yeah.
So I'll link to that blog piece as well because it is lovely.
Thank you.
And very, very much heartfelt, which is my favourite kind of thing to read. And also incredibly important. I think any extra voices that can be put behind that issue at the moment is a good thing.
Yeah, I think so too.
Anything impassioned, you know. Yes.
Please feel free to tweet us at Anxiety Aunts or directly to either of us at Anna Sparger Ryan or at Erin Array. You can find us on Facebook by searching The Anxiety Shut-In Hour. We have a Facebook page and you can also email us
anxietyaunts@gmail.com.
Correct.
And you can visit our website, which has all of the previous episodes and descriptions and everything that we've talked about in those episodes, links and things, at theanxietyshutinhour.com.
And always makes those just a little bit funny in some way. So I really like doing it even though I'm in the podcast. Like, I just want to go and see how she did it.
Oh, God, the pressure.
I'm such a nerd. It would be great if you enjoyed this episode or any of the episode, or just enjoy us generally.
please enjoy us.
Please enjoy us. If you could spread the word, so whether that's retweeting some of the stuff that we're doing or just telling your friends about us or rating and reviewing us on iTunes.
Have a safe and anxiety-free month, Erin.
Thanks.
Drive safely back to Shepparton.
Well, now that you've said it.
Yeah.
I have no choice.
I have to say that because I'm a parent.
Right.
Yeah, my parent guilt.
Yeah. You're not my parent, though.
Well, I might be. I mean, you're a bit older than me, so probably not your parent.
Probably not.
I say a bit older. You're, like, I mean, less than a year old.
It's like months.
Yeah, but even so, I didn't have a baby when I was still in the womb.
That would have been weird.
Pretty sure. My mum's never mentioned it, so...
It would have been like your mum was here today, so...
Yeah, like she was here earlier. She would have known that you were the baby that came out.
Yeah, like it would have been weird.
Yeah.
If she didn't, like, just mention it or, like, even just act a bit weird.
Yeah, like even if she just was like, oh, that's Erin, that baby that came out of my fetus. I really enjoy where this podcast goes.
At the end, we just... Yeah. Ta-da!
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Anna and Erin are not mental health professionals. This podcast is presented from their own personal perspectives as people who live with mental health issues. If you have a concern about yourself or someone you love, please contact a mental health professional for assistance.
I thought that was fun.